how can students and graduates make the most out of the students, their placements, and the grads, the trainee program?
Oh, that's a big question.
Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Dr. Scott Devenish, who is a QUT lecturer here and one of the paramedic leads. And we're going to have a chat today about the transition from student paramedic to graduate paramedic. And there's no better person to talk to about this than Scott, because he did his PhD in it. So I'm just going to get Scott to introduce himself a little bit.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, so I'm Scott. I'm a senior lecturer at QUT in the paramedic program. I've been at QUT for 12 years now. In that time, I've undertaken several different roles, from course coordinator, discipline lead, director of international engagement. So sort of a jack of all trades, a master of none.
I'm sure that's not quite true. Do you want to go through a little bit about why you found interest in that topic for your PhD?
Sure. So it goes back to when I was a ambulance educator for New South Wales Ambulance, and that was the vocational program back in the old days, before university was the main entrance point into the profession. And it was the early days of the university down there that started up parent degree as early as 1994, when I worked for New South Wales Education, Ambulance Education, we had graduates from the university coming through and doing the orientation. And back then, the induction was normally a 12-week process for people off the street who apply to become a paramedic. And then you go out as a probationary paramedic, and it took 3 years to get a diploma. But the graduates from the university, they had, from memory, I think it was 4 weeks. And unlike the old diploma program where you had a handhold, like you did your initial 12 weeks and you had sort of 9 to 12 months of handholding, a bit of an apprenticeship style that although you were second on a car, you were slowly introduced to the role of a paramedic. These guys did 4 weeks and then went out and rode. And it was a bit of a shock for them that they'd completed 3 years at university and all of a sudden they were now at the ambulance service in 4 weeks and then they're out there in the thick of it. Whereas other people, the old diploma program gave people a bit more of a hand-holding, a bit more supported sort of environment. And as an educator, because the program is reasonably new, it was, getting a head around what this university graduate looked like and what they could do, what they couldn't do, and they could intubate and decompress the tension pneumothorax and all these wondrous things, but struggled to put a bandage on because that was done in first year of the program, for example. So just getting our heads around how to prepare these people best to transition to the ambulance service, and I guess from there it really sparked an interest that university is the way of the future. The vocational program has pretty much been phased out everywhere but New South Wales, in ambulance in Australia. It was just working out what is it like for someone to transition from university to an ambulance service, because at university, from my experience working in the university sector for almost 15 years, it's a different culture to the ambulance service. Ambulance service is very regimented, very paramilitary, rank structure on the shoulders, whereas university is all about freedom of information, academic freedom, challenge the norms, question, critical thinking, whereas the old ambulance sort of modus operandi was, if it's not in the protocol book, you don't need to know it. A bit of a reality shock or a culture shock for the graduates coming through back, and this is going back 20-odd years, a bit of a culture shock coming from the university system to an ambulance service, and all ambulance services back then were very much vocationally based, and and a university graduate entering to a vocationally based workforce was a real challenge for them because they were an unknown entity.
So before you mentioned reality shock, and you talk about it quite a bit in your thesis. So do you want to go into a little bit more depth about what reality shock is and sort of how students on placement really, and also the new grads can navigate it to ensure that they're having a really good experience still?
Look, just the reality shock of joining an ambulance service is one thing. I remember when I joined 24 years ago now, we did marching practice. We used to raise and lower flags. We used to bring an ambulance around from the depot and park it outside the education centre and do a pre-shift check and check all the equipment. And it was just, that was a bit of reality shock compared to, working as a nurse, that it's very regimented. And so I can get it from that point of view. But I guess the reality shock from a graduate point of view, I suppose we're looking at the literature, is that quite often the idea behind what people think a paramedic does and what the reality of practice is can be a bit of a discordance between those two ideas. And getting used to the reality of practice of being a paramedic, it can cause a reality shock because it really questions your whole way of thinking and what this picture you've built up in your mind, what it is to be a paramedic. Which is then it's influenced by things such as the media, TV news, God forbid those programs like All Saints or what are some of the ones these days? They've got, Chicago Fire and Casualty and all those ambulance programs, Ambulance Australia. And look, they're pretty good. I mean, the rally of practice, but, the whole sort of soap operas and, this... showing that the world's catching on fire and love affairs between parents. Well, it just does happen, but not as much as the TV show, I guess, show it does. So, and also, get this idea that it's go, 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 24/7 action, and if that was reality, you'd burn out after three shifts and have post-traumatic stress before, your 12 months is up. Whereas, reality is most of our patients are elderly fallers. And the vast majority of cases are chronic health, not the lights and sirens, blood and guts, and cardiac arrests. I mean, I think Queensland, you'd be lucky if you did more 1,600 a year of the whole service that you work on. So, it's this idea of it's all go, 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 blood, guts doing arrest drills, it's not quite reality.
That you all taught us in first years. I think it was one of the first things you said in the first lectures that, 2%, if that, are going to be the big trauma, lights and sirens, the big jobs that you picture and you see on TV. Yes. Well, it's something that's come up a lot on this podcast with everyone. And I guess that's really important. So that is the shock, I guess. And from there, do you find that because of that reality shock that people are becoming a little bit more, I guess, negative or jaded towards the job or getting sort of burnt out more quickly from that if they're not understanding this idea of, reality shock?
It's a process of dealing with it. When you look at, all due respect to people who have got the military backgrounds out there, but, you sort of see army recruitment ads that it shows, this life of adventure and but then, when the bullets are flying, it's anything but adventure. It's pretty horrendous. So, it's kind of if they sold the reality of war, people most likely wouldn't join the military. Some would, but it's just like ambulance services. If you sort of sold someone standing in triage ramp for 6 hours with a very bored look on their face or attending a patient with really gross cellulitis, it's not going to be the kind of sexy stuff like hanging out of a helicopter and intubating and showing, driving lights and sirens. So it's what people think that we do. The view you build in your head as a youngster then carries on through to adulthood. And, we can tell people at the beginning of the degree that, we used to get someone like, a very respected paramedic, like Tony Hucker, in to sort of say, hey, it's not all blood and guts and lights and sirens. But then you sort of revert back to your preconceived ideas, especially when you hear sessional educators talking about hangings and shootings and car crashes, and you know, you're hanging off your chair, and quite often, even though I've been a paramedic for 23-24 years, because I'm working at university, the research showed that students would most likely believe something a sessional educator said who's been a paramedic for 3 years compared to someone who's been in for 24 years, because they're seen as, well, they're currently out there, whereas, you know, my practice is at university now. So you build up these really strong ideas of what it's all about, and then when you get the ambulance service, you've got to almost disentangle yourself from that, and that can cause some people to get quite frustrated with what's going on with the reality of practice, you know. People calling an ambulance because it's cheaper to call an ambulance, and because the ambulance, the train station is next door to the hospital, they needed to get a taxi. Or, you know, you get called to someone who, you know, he's got respiratory distress or not breathing, and you drive like an absolute nut for 30 minutes, and they're waiting outside with a suitcase and walk to the ambulance. You know, things like that. That reality practice are really great to the people. So you get some people who, the idea of reality grates so much with their preconceived ideas, they will leave. And we call that behavioural capitulation. So they'll say, look, this is not for me. This is not what I thought it was going to be. Or they may go into education or management or some other area of the ambulance service, so they can still maintain the identity of a paramedic but not be exposed to the reality, because it's just too painful that the reality and their thoughts just don't meet. You get some people that get really jaded. It's not what they thought it was, so they get jaded and almost sort of sell their soul to the culture of, you attend a job that maybe isn't acute and critical, and that person probably didn't need an ambulance. So some people then go, well, that was a nothing job, or, you know, thinking that only good job is a trauma and blood and guts and lights and sirens. So they get quite jaded. And there is a certain culture around, you know, the badge of honour for a paramedic is trauma and cardiac arrests. That's, you know, after a good trauma case, you know, that the paramedics feel like they've done something. But if it's an elderly person falling over and put back to bed, for some reason that's viewed by some people in the culture as being, you know, nothing job, even though the reason for that person falling could be quite complex. So, so we call it value capitulations, where they sort of sell their soul to the culture to fit in. Whereas what we really want is this whole idea of biculturalism, where you merge what you've learned at university, evidence-based practice, critical thinking, and to question and reflect with the ambulance culture, and make it easier for those coming from behind, you know, coming behind you. So the initial graduates Queensland had a 10-year phase of when they started the university program and then basically switched off the diploma. Whereas other ambulance services had a lot shorter period. So I think for the early graduates heading out there, they had a pretty hard time cracking the culture. And look, when I joined, 4% of paramedics had degrees. But now it's a lot more than that, probably, you know, up around the maybe even 60%. And don't quote me on that figure, but a lot more now. So it's a lot more accepted. But the initial people had a really hard time, and have paved the way for graduates to have a lot better transition today. Having said that, some still have a terrible time, but on the whole, it's a lot better than it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really interesting you say that, because when reading, you did say that in your thesis that, you know, there'd be a lot of stigmatisation for those students coming out. But having been through multiple placements now it's kind of this accepted norm that pretty much everyone that's going into the jobs nowadays are coming from university. So I think there's less stigmatisation, that marginalisation basically of those students. But it's interesting when you said the trauma is like that, you know, badge of honour for paramedics. And I hear a lot of students, and this is something that my last mentor and I discussed on placement, was a lot of students always say, I need to go experience, you know, a really big trauma job to see how I'll react to it. And it's something that's, yeah, they all want to like go to a big job just to see how they'll react. But we were talking about how, you know, you don't want to necessarily, like the longer you get into maybe uni and throughout the job, you don't actually want to go to the trauma ones all the time, just because you don't know, like the same trauma job, you know, you might go to a car crash once and then go to it again, and it might completely be different for you mentally. Like you might be impacted by the second one different to the first one. So I guess it's even coming with students as well. It's that badge of honour of trauma, or, you know, wanting to experience it.
Yeah. You say that saying, you know, you sit around wanting the big job, but when the big job happens, you wish it didn't. I guess from my research, you have people hitting that level of confidence when they've got this list in their mind of different cases that they're a little bit curious or fearful about, like, you know, things like murders or suicides or pediatric arrest, or, you know, all these jobs you build up in your mind of being, or how would I cope with that? And the big job is probably one of those. And after you've been in the service for a period of time, you start ticking these jobs off your list and thinking, well, hey, I managed that, you know, and I haven't got any complaints, so maybe, you know, maybe I'm doing all right. So I think it's a confidence builder thing, but it really comes back to why someone is actually joining the ambulance service. Is it, you know, is it to save lives, or is it to make a difference in people's lives that, you know, having a horrendous day and you're bringing some sort of calm to their chaos? Is it to drive fast? Is it because you like the uniform? And people sort of say, you know, ambulance services are a get-rich-slow scheme. Maybe for the money, may not be, but the whole reason they've joined in the first place may have some bearing on, you know, want to do the big job because that's what I think being a paramedic is all about. And you know, when I've done that, I can feel like a real paramedic. Whereas being triaged, ramped, or dealing with someone who's fallen over, or that, you know, just chatting to someone in the back of the ambulance because the drugs you have, you know, it's more of a chronic health issue and it's really outside your scope. And they just need to be transported to hospital. It doesn't make someone feel like a paramedic. It's got to be doing something, doing some sort of intervention. I mean, you know, when I joined, we used to put oxygen on everyone, and you used to feel like you're doing something by putting oxygen on someone. But now, after the British Thoracic Society sort of said, well, the oxygen's kind of dangerous to some people, it's kind of, well, what do you do now? Well, I've got to talk to them, I suppose. But, so I think it's that preconceived idea of you know, the TV shows and the news and.
For sure, and that's a really good summation, basically, of that. But you talked about basically having that preconceived idea, or what technically is your why? Is it, you know, does it go beyond helping people? Because realistically, when things are going to get tough, you're going to have to fall back on that why, or why you, the purpose why you got into the job. So how important is actually having a pretty solid why when you're transitioning from that student to grad? Because if you're having things like the reality shock and really struggling at times, or even when just you go to a bad job,
you'll always have an adjustment. You don't hit the road, you know, totally competent and know exactly what you're doing. Not unless you've been an honorary for some period of time, like, you know, old days you used to have honorary paramedics or people in the country that used, you know, came in via diploma or degree. But you're always going to have a learning process, and it's going to take time to get to know the system. I mean, look, university is really good about teaching clinical matters and you know, how to recognise certain ailments or diseases, or, you know, but what we're not so good at is the whole the routine side of things, such as, you know, meal breaks and on scene times and how to use an MDT, and, you know, there's little cultural nuances about, you know, station cleaning and all those things which you're not necessarily going to, and like, and where to get a feed at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, so you know, paramedics, well, that's it, or some sort of kebab shop. But so it's still gonna be a learning curve for people. How can people sort of decrease the reality shock, I suppose you're asking? Learn as much as you can about, and talk to lots of paramedics, talk to graduates who are recent graduates, but, you know, to get an idea of what it's really like out there. So talk to some of the old hands that no longer sort of see trauma as their go-to, that they're quite happy to deal with an elderly person with COPD instead of, you know, someone who's been smashed in front of a truck. So get a wide sort of variety of sort of, you know, views, and a really good way to do that is by attending professional development activities run by someone like this Australasian College of Paramedicine or like bodies where people come along, and a bit of a networking thing, and just questioning what you perceive it's all about and what they think it's all about. You know, from my research, the people that had the most grounded view of what a paramedic does is people that volunteered with St John Ambulance, Royal Surf Life Saving, Royal Bushfire Brigade, or whatever you call it here in Queensland. So they had a bit more of an idea, whereas people who relied on television had a really unrealistic view of what it's all about.
For sure, and there's some really good points in terms of talking to your grads and basically networking with as many people as you can and sharing those experiences, because one of the graduate paramedics interviewed on here, we spoke about what one of the challenges were, and it was the logistics of just getting around station, basically trying to figure out all the meal breaks and all of the cleaning that, you know, that station did, because he said he knew the content. He'd been at uni, he knew some of the content, you know, and could rattle off all the protocols, but it was just, you know, all the nuanced stuff, as you were mentioning, that became a bit of a challenge point.
And you know, some of the data from my PhD or things such as, well, I've got to get up and, you know, drive an hour to the ambulance station and turn up half hour early to do a shift check and be there with a smile on my face and happy and all that kind of thing. Whereas at university, if I didn't turn up to class, nobody cared. So there's that stepping up into, well, now you're an emergency service or a health, the emergency service wing of the health system, and people are counting on you. It's not like, you know, so that adjustment, so that life skills people learn just about any workplace, but life skills and workability. And I guess another thing that came out from the data was that a lot of the support subjects or the not the core fundamental science-y sort of anatomies, pathophys, pharmacology and clinical skills and paramedic management units, but the communication, the law and ethics, the sociology or the organisational awareness or you know, all those determinants of health. And a lot of people sort of, a lot of students don't see the point. They just want to do the clinical stuff. But once you get out and road, you sort of, you know, came through in the data quite clearly that people, you know, graduates are going, oh, geez, I should have listened a bit more there. You know, this is more than just plugging holes with bandages and giving drugs. It's a whole another level to, you know, socioeconomic status and determinants of health and access to healthcare and health literacy and you know, aged people in society that don't have the support services. And there's all that complex nature to managing a patient. It's not just clear cutters, CPR and plugging holes and off we go.
Yeah, well, for sure it makes sense, because realistically all that clinical stuff and, as you mentioned, just the systematic approach to everything will be helpful for that 2% of the job, that trauma, that cardiac arrest, whatever it may be, but it's all that social determinants of health, all the health literacy for the 98% of people that are quite complex or lower, that might, you know, might be labelled as low acuity, but there's a lot going on. So I guess one of the other things that we don't get taught at uni necessarily, that, yeah, mentoring others. And when we become a grad, I know my last placement, my second day, and a new grad popped up and I was with him and another person. But, you know, you might be on your first day and have a student, and whilst you may not necessarily be their particular preceptor, you're still in that role of technically being a mentor. How do you, what sort of research have you done in that sort of mentor-mentee space and that relationship?
Look, it formed a key part of the PhD, looking at the experiences of students undertaking placement, but then also the experiences of paramedics once they're graduated and actually have to look after someone. And it came through clearly that a lot of ambulance, and remember this study was several ambulance services in Australia as well as, you know, the UK, so it was an international study, that a lot of services didn't actually offer any formalised mentor training to their staff. And as we know, you look at the APRA standards, it's to mentor is I think domain 4 from memory, that it's an expected part of being a paramedic. Some ambulance services have a designated clinical instructor and they actually train someone up and give them extra allowance to do that, but because there's only so many clinical instructors, you can only have so many students out at once. Whereas other services have, you know, blocks or large amounts of students but don't actually provide you know, any mentor training as such. So I guess it's important for some graduates or even students to realise that their mentor or being a mentor is, you know, it's expected part of the job, and people aren't really taught how to do that. They're taught how to be clinicians. It goes back to the old days. We used to think if someone's a really good clinician, they're going to be a good manager, going to be a good educator, going to be, you know, that's not the case. Someone might be a really good clinician, but you put him in a senior management position or a station manager position, and it's a real learning curve. And vice versa, someone might be a great clinician, but you put them in an educator role, may not work. So, you know, people have their specialties. It's not like you can be, you know, good at one thing means good at everything. And that was a real sort of, you know, cultural expectation that if you're good at one thing, well, they must be good at this and this and this and this, which is not necessarily the case. So your mentor may not, you know how to be a good educator. They might be a really good paramedic, but because they have the building blocks there, they've got no real frame of reference. Some will go out and do some extra reading and some, you know, and talking to other people and build, you know, and have had some really horrendous experiences themselves and go, well, I'm not going to actually wish that upon my worst enemy. But I did find in my study that some people then, you know, you come across participants who say, look, my mentor basically pushed me and made life hell for me and said, look, you know, you're going to be a paramedic and you better start acting like it, and I'm not going to be light on you, you know, I'm going to push you, and you know, unless I do that, you know, you won't be as good a paramedic as you can be. And they remember that they said they absolutely hated it. But then they find themselves doing the same thing to their graduates because they've got no other frame of reference, and the cycle continues that, well, this is what happened with me. I hated it, but I don't know what else to do, so I'm going to do that too. And you know, within the overall culture, you've got micro cultures. So there might be one station that's everyone wants to work at, fabulous station, but like just 10K down the road, there's another station which, you know, people don't want to work there because it's just got a really terrible reputation of infighting and you know, giving grads a really hard time. So, you know, it depends on you know, if you've got a recent graduate at a station that's really supportive. You know, there's stories of graduates having a really hard time out in road, and then when they get a student, they give that student a really hard time because that's what they do at that station, and they do that to fit in. So there's a whole lot of aspects to it, but yeah, so not every paramedic is taught how to be a mentor. And when you think about your learning style, and I sort of talked about this at a couple of paramedic events about different styles of supervision, and, you know, you've got contractual, directoral, laissez-faire and pastoral, and you've got some that are really supportive and some that have got a really high structure, so high support, low structure, you know. So pastoral, for example, would be very supportive but not a high structure, whereas contractual will be both high structure, high support. Directoral will be you know, high structure, low support. So it depends on what particular style you prefer, whereas laissez-faire will be, she'll be right, off you go, I'll stop you going to kill someone, apart from that, you're it. So you might have a preference for a contractual style of learning. You want your mentor to be a contractual mentor, but they may be pastoral or laissez-faire, and that's when the fight starts. Same idea that, you know, their style, will potentially grate with what the student expects or the student wants. And university students always want a lot of feedback, and which is good for learning. You know, where did I go wrong? How can I improve? You know, I want to get that 7. I want to get the high distinction. But when you get down the road, you only normally hear feedback when it's not so good. So that whole idea of when you hear nothing, you're doing all right. But when you hear something, it's most likely negative. So, you know, the mentor may not want to, may not provide students with as much feedback as they want. And when it is feedback, it could be negative. And you know, the student wants, you know, lots of feedback and lots of direction and lots of support, but the mentor style isn't like that, and that's when a bit of a clash can occur with expectations of what you want from your mentor, and their experience and their ability to mentor may not be in line with what the expectations are. So that's always been one of those things about, I mean, you know, is it the ambulance service's responsibility to upskill their workforce to be mentors, or is it something the university should do? I think it should be a bit of a blended model, a bit of both, and which is what we're looking at, especially now APRA expects us to, you know, one of the domains is mentor and mentorship and leadership. But, yeah, so there's a whole, and it wasn't just Australia, it was also the UK that that parents aren't necessarily taught to be mentors.
Yeah, for sure. And so are there any types of, I guess, an approach to be a good mentor or as a student or as a grad, sort of outlaying, you know, what you'd expect, your expectations from the start? Because sometimes they'll be like, what are your expectations of this placement or as a grad, you know, would you do that to whoever is your mentor? Or do you just have any strategies to kind of go around that?
Communication is good. So, you know, always have a good chat to your mentor to start off with, to sort of say, well, hey, this is how I prefer to learn. And this is, you know, this is what, you know, this is what I, where I think my gaps are, and this is what I think I need to work on, and really, you know, appreciate your views after a couple of shifts. And but then you got the other side of things where the Ambulance culture can be a little bit funny, that your mentors may have had a previous university student, maybe from a different university, or a graduate or whatever. And they didn't realise all the buttons they could push to piss off their mentor, and have pressed every single one of them and have just given their mentor an absolute horrendous time. A new student rocks up and the culture seems to paint university students with the same brush until you prove yourself. So if you turn up and get a bit of resistance, it may not be you, it may be the previous person they've had, but they're still sort of a little bit wary and might take a couple of shifts for them to work out that, oh, this, you know your stuff and you're keen and, oh, like, I can work with you. I guess another thing too is if you're a bit of a shrinking violet and you don't want to get involved, they're probably not going to give you as much time and attention and things to do as if you know, compared if you want to sort of jump in boots and all within your scope. So there's a few things to consider, but I think dialogue and I think that whole trust thing of you know, which you can't control necessarily, because if the last grad, the student or grad they've had is being really challenging, well, initially they're going to be a bit wary of you. So I suppose understand that it might take a shift or two for you to sort of work them out, for them to work you out. Because I guess the other thing too is some students expect to turn up to the ambulance station and be treated like an equal, and you know, for the whole world to revolve around them. But you're not on the payroll. You're a visitor to the workplace. You're not part of their culture. You want to be, but you're not part of their culture, and it may take a little bit of time for them to work you out. And you know, you don't go in and tell jokes with someone on the first day. And look, paramedics are notorious for taking the piss out of each other as a term of endearment. If a student rocks up in the station and doesn't know them from a bar of soap and starts to involve in that banter, it's not going to go well. So you just got to work them out, and they've got to work you out. And having said that, you might rock up the station, have fabulous mentors and have a wonderful time and go to station barbecues and, you know, a real social station, or you might go to a station where the culture's not as accepting and have a really hard time. Those that are a bit more socially outgoing have a bit more easier time and can get on with different people. But if you butt up against the culture and continue to do that you have a pretty hard time.
Definitely. And that's, a really good overview of pretty much conflict resolution, I guess, using communication and understanding sort of where your mentor is coming from.
And I think that the whole sort of conflict side of things, go back 10 odd years, and a reason for the conflict could be you're a university graduate with a degree and your mentor doesn't have a degree and is threatened by you. Now, I've taught in both the vocational sector in New South Wales Ambulance and the university sector in New South Wales and in Queensland, and the clinical skills we teach you are the same. There's no difference in the clinical skills. If anything, ambulance service is always very clinically focused and very good at skills. It's something they push heavily. I guess the difference is that the universities give you the background, sort of, you know, the sociology, the psychology, the mental health, you know, all that other stuff that prepares you for your future career, not just the here and now, which a vocational program will do. So they feel very threatened, but there's no reason for them to feel threatened, because, you know, that the clinical skills and the management of cases, I mean, the teaching is the same, and you know, a lot of us went through the vocational system too. So, you know, there's no real reason to feel threatened, but I guess it's that stigmatization of this new category of paramedic that we don't know, and we just need to maintain our cultural base, and hence you know, we're going to paint them all with the same brush and sort of to, you know, so I don't feel so threatened. But again, that's slowly, that's not as prevalent as it used to be. But yeah, that whole, you know, you're not on the payroll. You're not going to get equal acceptance until you put the uniform on. It's this theory called the marginal theory. Initially, it was people coming out from, Italy and Greece. They came out to Australia and also the United States, that they were no longer part of their original culture but weren't part of Australian culture and had to sort of integrate into, they weren't sort of accepted by the Australian culture, but they weren't in their dominant culture, and they're sort of in no man's land, and that's that marginal theory, and it takes time to integrate into the new culture. But you can still bring aspects of your old culture and change their culture. You know, like for instance, thinking about some of the Italian food and European food, and it's part of our culture now, but back then it wasn't. And so the whole biculturalism idea of their brought some of their culture and made our culture for the better. So you can apply that to graduates, that you're no longer at university, you're outside your comfort space. You're in an animal, so you may even get to the animal station and not even work out how to get in because you don't know where the door is, which has happened.
Done that as a student.
But it takes time to get accepted, and some will not actually be accepted till they put the uniform on, and get, even get to the point of getting through their 9, 10, 12 month internship or 6 month internship, depending.
Yeah, for sure, and that makes a lot of sense. So I guess then we'll sort of cap it off, or we'll start to wrap it up in terms of how can students and graduates make the most out of, for the students, their placements and the grads, that transition program or the trainee program?
Oh, that's a big question because it varies depending on, where you're at, and it's such an open-ended question. But again, I think integrating into, like networking with, get involved with student paramedic associations and attend events and, link in with people actually, already working in the profession, even, managers and educators, and you get a bit of a wide variety or a wide view of what it's really like out there. On placement, initially keep your head down and, just suss your mentors out. Don't go in there, telling a critical care paramedic of 30 years that they're intubating wrong. So be respectful and just slowly work them out. And if you do have look, personality clashes happen. Conflict is part of the role of a paramedic. Conflict, you might get a blast from a triage nurse, or you might have a critical care paramedic turn up and give you a blast because you haven't done something, or the patient may get cranky at you, the patient's loved ones may get cranky at you because you weren't fast enough. I mean, at the moment, it's pretty hectic out there with lots of ramping and response times. It could be an hour between a couple of hours between when the call goes down, when you actually get there, and the tensions and emotions running high. So conflict is a part of being a paramedic, and it can be, over a period of time, it can be cumulative and adversely affect your mental health. But if you do have conflict with a mentor on your placement, you need to reach out to your placement supervisor or your course coordinator and start the process of well, what can I do? What's available to me? Because I'm just not learning here. It's actually, really, really affecting me. And there's always two sides to the story. So obviously the course coordinator will have a chat and ask for any notes or, any information about what's going on and what's happened and before then we start talking to the ambulance service. And it could mean the students move to a different location or swap for lines, or it could be as simple as a misunderstanding between the mentor and the student. The mentor's had a really bad day or going through a marriage breakdown or whatever have you. So when you graduate, you're going to be working with a person for 10 weeks and there could be points, when you're both tired, you might clash, but you need to be able to move beyond that with at least dialogue and communication first, and then talking to station managers and university unit coordinators to help manage that. And then do realise at the beginning of your placement that may not be you, it may be the previous person, that they're just so frustrated and with, and it may take a shift or two for them to work out that, well, you're not like that, you're keen, and you know your stuff.
Absolutely. They have some pretty good points, and yeah, that conflict resolution is something that pretty much gets asked about all the time, so that's a really good point. Just yeah, communicating if there is really bad things going on, absolutely reach out.
And of course, it's highly inappropriate behaviour. Well, then that needs to be reported. But quite often, a lot of conflict is not over big things; it's over small things, and they accumulate and can cause people to fall out. It's not normally just the one thing that causes things to explode. It's normally several things over a period of time.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So, just to finish off, is there anything that you think is really important that needs to be shared before we sort of wrap up?
Where do we start? look, transition is always a hard thing. So it transition from university to the workplace is a hard thing. Changing jobs, so if you go from one end of the service to another, that's a hard thing. So transition is always challenging. It's never easy. People don't like change. So be easy on yourself. Don't expect yourself to be Rambo Ambo and get in there day one and be an absolute hero. That's going to take time. So be kind to yourself. Reach out to friends, family, and supportive people. And a lot of it's life skills. It can take time, and it may even take 6 to 9 months to actually build up your confidence, and then you become qualified and you lose your confidence, have to start all over again. So especially if you're regional, you've done your placement in a regional area where you haven't had a lot of work, and you go to the city and you're really busy, and people don't know you from bar or soap, they just see you got qualified paramedic on your shoulder and they expect you your stuff. So, be kind to yourself.
Awesome. I think that's a perfect way to wrap it up. Well, thank you so much for coming and having a chat, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.